Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I've got to be honest with you guys, I'm a little bit drunk for the first time in like 6.5 years. I stopped drinking for 6 years, not for any reason, I just stopped on a New Year's Eve resolution. A buddy of mine was doing it for his New Year's resolution and I didn't have one, so I'm like, okay, I'll do that. The idea was, his New Year's resolution was to not drink for all of January. And I was like, yeah, cool. I don't have a resolution, so I'll do that too. And then 6 years later, I still hadn't had a single drink. Anyway, so I started drinking again maybe 6 months ago. I had a beer, you know. But on no occasion did I have more than a beer. There's been a few nights where I've had a beer with a mate or a beer with dinner. But I think there might have been one writer's group where I had two beers. But tonight, I had three beers. And I'm such a lightweight now that I'm actually pretty drunk from three beers. Oh, gosh. We had beer on our rider. Our band played a gig tonight. I play in a band. I play bass guitar in a band called Verona Lights. And, yeah. They gave me three beers for free, so I drank them. VB. I wonder if any Americans out there have tried a VB, Victoria Bitter beer. It's a very bogan beer. Quite nice, though. Anyway, we're here tonight to discuss The Brothers Karamazov, Book 6, Chapter 1. I'm sorry if I slur my words a bit. I'm such a lightweight. I'm really quite drunk, considering I only had three beers. Oh, God, head spinning. Keep it together, Andy. You can do this. The questions that I asked you guys about Book 6, Chapter 1 were these. We made it back to Zossima in time. A bit of a surprise. Thoughts? How will Zossima's final wishes and his death affect Alyosha? And general discussion. I am a Norwegian said, hey, we finally learned why Zossima bowed down to Dmitri. I did not expect to see Zossima alive again. Every time he's been mentioned after Alyosha first left him, I've felt the same way. I have no idea how Alyosha will react. He will grieve, obviously, but we also know that he is radically accepting. One thing I'm pretty sure of is that Zossima's death will only deepen Alyosha's commitment to Zossima's plan for him. Yeah, I think that's a pretty safe bet. Zossima has already expressed to him that he wants him to leave the monastery, to find a wife, and to pursue his spiritual course outside of the monastery. To be a monk, but not to be, in the monastery. And, yeah, I think you're right. I think his death will strengthen Alyosha's resolve to fulfill that wish. Somastar says, often I forget that this book is being told by an unnamed monk. This chapter brought it back. Jordan Z said, this is the first instance that I recall where our narrator seems to doubt that he has the full story. It's interesting that the whole book so far contains every detail of every conversation presented as fact, until here where the narrator stresses a few times that the details come from Alyosha's and others' tellings. Laura Y. Stitch says, I like that he mentioned the conversations are not exactly as they were spoken. He explains why the speech is not always quite natural. I thought that was interesting because I can understand why he's done that, to set up the fact that the next chapter will be told in an unnatural fashion. It's going to be, it's not how he would have said these things. It's filled in with gaps, and it's the interjections from other people listening have been omitted. But he kind of could have said the same thing for the previous few chapters, or a lot of the chapters, where these characters go on these big long rants that seem so unnatural to me, where they go on for 5, 10, 15 minutes of talking uninterrupted. It kind of, for me, breaks the narrative a little bit because I can't imagine that. I can't imagine a scene where you're having a conversation with someone else and they just talk for a straight 10 minutes without you having any input. But that seems to happen a lot. So it is good that they put that little explanation in there, but it kind of seems like they're explaining that for the upcoming chapter where Zossima tells his story. But why haven't they done that with the previous ones? Techrific says, interesting to find that Zossima is much improved, if we're to believe Alyosha. Zossima loves Alyosha so much because he reminds him of his beloved brother that apparently died young. Zossima not only had a premonition about Dmitri, but it turns out he prognosticate much pain and suffering for Alyosha as well. Prognosticate means foretell or prophesize.
Prognosticate.
A poor lad. Okay. Wait, so Zossima is predicting, prognosticating pain and suffering in Alyosha's future. Okay. Alyosha is moved and relieved to see Zossima in a better state, but all the pent-up emotions come flooding out of him, and the tension has taken its toll on Alyosha. I fear for him when Zossima finally kicks the bucket, because if ever there was a father figure and mentor worth every ruble and kopeck, it surely is Zossima. Again, poor Alyosha. The country wench from Vishigui that gave 60 kopecks to the monastery is fondly remembered. I had to look her up, and she appeared on page 66 in my version with her daughter Lizaveta. That was 2 days ago in story, but it's been over a month for us. Damn. Yeah, I remember her with the daughter that Zossima came out the front of the monastery and spoke to the crowd, and Vishigui was in that crowd, I think, if I'm not mistaken. Techrific also said this, I wish I could send my copy to Ander because this translation is much better than Garnet, in my honest opinion, although the prose isn't really fantastic in Avsees either. But it flows much nicer, and some of the redundancy has been weeded out. Dosto really did a number on us all with his last book, but it's not really the prose that's the appeal, it's the ideas. Oh, with his last book. It's his last book. It's not the prose that's the appeal, it's the ideas and the characters that, although they are embodiments, are fully fledged characters that seem real, despite the fact that some of them are very Russian, i.e. hyper-emotional, tightly wound, ticking psychological bombs. Okay. Yeah, I would have to say, Tech, you're probably right. I think the translation I'm reading is probably needs to... a lot of the blame for the fact that I'm not enjoying the prose must come down to the translator. And, yeah, I have heard that some of the other English translations are better, but I don't think there are any other English translations other than Garnet that are in the public domain. I might be mistaken. I hope I'm mistaken. Maybe I can do a little switchover. But I'm pretty sure only the Garnet one is in the public domain, which means if I'm going to read it on a recording, I can't read a newer one because those are copyrighted translations. So I need one of the older ones. So I might be stuck with Garnet. But maybe I should look into that and see if there is another public domain English translation. That would solve that problem. Yeah, weeding out the redundancy sounds very appealing, because that's really what's my main grievance with it, is the redundant language. There's just so much of it. Now, what we are going to do with this next chapter, let me just double check this actually. Okay, so this next chapter is broken up into, like, parts A, B, C. I'm not sure how far it goes up. I can see A, B. Okay, C, D. Sorry about this dead air. D. What was up to? D. Okay, might just go... Oh, no. Okay. D takes us right through to chapter 3, and then chapter 3 starts with part E. But what I'm going to do is this next couple of chapters, they're broken up into A, B, C, D, E, etc. I'm going to read them probably just one of those per day. So today I'm just going to read A, part A. Now, I might do two of them in another podcast. We'll kind of play it by ear a bit. But yeah, we might pace it at those those little checkpoints, especially tonight because I am a bit drunk. And I don't want to be struggling through a long chapter when I can barely see straight. All right, so this is book 6, chapter 2, which is called Notes of the Life of the Deceased Priest and Monk, the Elder Zosima, taken from his own words by Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov. It's a long chapter name. And the subtitle is Biographical Notes A, Father Zosima's Brother. Okay, so this is part A, Father Zosima's Brother. Beloved fathers and teachers, I was born in a distant province in the north, in the town of V. My father was a gentleman by birth, but of no great consequence or position. He died when I was only 2 years old, and I don't remember him at all. He left my mother a small house built of wood and a fortune. Not large, but sufficient to keep her and her children in comfort. There were two of us, my older brother Markel and I. He was 8 years older than I was, of hasty, irritable temperament, but kind-hearted and never ironical. He was remarkably silent, especially at home with me, his mother, and the servants. He did well at school, but did not get on with his schoolfellows, though he never quarrelled, at least so my mother has told me. 6 months before his death, when he was 17, he made friends with a political elite who had been banished from Moscow to our town for free thinking, and led a solitary existence there. He was a good scholar, who had gained distinction in philosophy in the university. Something made him take a fancy to Markel, and he used to ask him to see him. The young man would spend whole evenings with him during that winter, till the exile was summoned to Petersburg to take up his post again at his own request, as he had powerful friends. It was the beginning of Lent, and Markel would not fast. He was rude and laughed at. "That's all silly twaddle, and there is no God," he said, horrifying my mother, the servants, and me too, for though I was only 9, I too was aghast at hearing such words. We had 4 servants, all serfs. I remember my mother selling one of the 4, the cook, Efimia, who was lame and elderly, for 60 paper rubles, and hiring a free servant to take her place. In the 6th week in Lent, my brother, who was never strong and had a tendency to consumption, was taken ill. He was tall but thin and delicate looking, and of very pleasing countenance. I suppose he caught cold. Anyway, the doctor, who came, soon whispered to my mother that it was galloping consumption, that he would not live through spring. My mother began weeping, and careful not to alarm my brother, she entreated him to go to church and confess and take the sacrament, as he was still able to move about. This made him angry, and he said something profane about the church. He grew thoughtful, however. He guessed at once that he was seriously ill, and that was why his mother was begging him to confess and take the sacrament. He had been aware, indeed, for a long time past, that he was far from well, and had a year before coolly observed at dinner to your mother and me, "My life won't be long among you, I may not live yet another year," which seemed now like a prophecy. 3 days passed, and Holy Week had come, and on Tuesday morning my brother began going to church. "I am doing this simply for your sake, mother, to please and comfort you," he said. My mother wept with joy and grief. His end must be near, she thought, if there's such a change in him. But he was not able to go to church long. He took to his bed, so he had to confess and take the sacrament at home. It was late Easter, and the days were bright, fine, and full of fragrance. I remember he used to cough all night and sleep badly. But in the morning he dressed and tried to sit up in the armchair. That's how I remember him sitting, sweet and gentle, smiling, his face bright and joyous, in spite of his illness. A marvellous change passed over him. His spirit seemed transformed. The old nurse would come in and say, "Let me light the lamp before the holy image, my dear." And once he would not have allowed it, and would have blown it out. "Light it, dear. I was a wretch to have prevented you doing it. You are praying when you light the lamp, and I am praying when I rejoice seeing you. So we are praying to the same God. Those words seemed strange to us. And mother would go to her room and weep, but when she went in to him, she wiped her eyes and looked cheerful. Mother, don't weep, darling, he would say. I've long to live yet, long to rejoice with you, and life is glad and joyful. Ah, dear boy, how can you talk of joy when you lie feverish at night, coughing as though you would tear yourself to pieces? Don't cry, mother, he would answer. Life is paradise, and we are all in paradise, but we won't see it. If we would, we should have heaven on earth the next day. Everyone wondered at his words. He spoke so strangely and positively. We were all touched and wept. Friends came to see us. Dear ones, he would say to them, what have I done that you should love me so? How can you love anyone like me? And how was it I did not know? I did not appreciate it before. When the servants came in to him, he would say continually, dear kind people, why are you doing so much for me? Do I deserve to be waited on? If it were God's will for me to live, I would wait on you, for all men should wait on one another. Mother shook her head as she listened. My darling, it's your illness makes you talk like that. Mother, darling, he would say, there must be servants and masters, but if so, I will be the servant of my servants, the same as they are to me. And another thing, mother, every one of us has sinned against all men, and I more than any. Mother positively smiled at that, smiled through her tears. Why, how could you have sinned against all men more than all? Robbers and murderers have done that, but what sin have you committed yet, that you hold yourself more guilty than all? Mother, little heart of mine, he said. He had begun using such strange, caressing words at that time. Little heart of mine, my joy, believe me, everyone is really responsible to all men and for everything. I don't know how to explain it to you, but I feel it is so painfully even. And how is it we went on living, getting angry and not knowing? So he would get up every day, more and more sweet and joyous and full of love. When the doctor, an old German called Eisenschmidt, came, well, doctor, have I another day in this world? He would ask, joking. You'll live many days yet, the doctor would answer, and months and years too. Months and years, he would exclaim. Why, reckon the days. One day is enough for a man to know all happiness. My dear ones, why do we quarrel? Try to outshine each other and keep grudges against each other. Let's go straight into the garden, walk and play there, and love and appreciate and kiss each other and glorify life. Your son cannot last long, the doctor told my mother as she accompanied him to the door. The disease is affecting his brain. The windows of his room looked out into the garden, and our garden was a shady one, with old trees in it which were coming into bud. The first birds of spring were flitting in the branches, chirping, chirruping, and singing at the windows. And looking at them and admiring them, he began suddenly begging for forgiveness. Their forgiveness. Birds of heaven, happy birds, forgive me, for I have sinned against you too. None of us could understand that at the time, but he shed tears of joy. Yes, he said, there was such a glory of God all about me, birds, trees, meadows, sky, only I lived in shame and dishonored it all, and did not notice the beauty and glory. You take too many sins on yourself, mother used to say, weeping. Mother, darling, it's for joy, not for grief I am crying. Though I can't explain it to you, I like to humble myself before them, for I don't know how to love them enough. If I have sinned against everyone, yet all forgive me too, and that's heaven. Am I not in heaven now? And there was a great deal more I don't remember. I remember I went once into his room when there was no one else there. It was a bright evening. The sun was setting, and the whole room was lighted up. He beckoned me, and I went up to him. He put his hands on my shoulders and looked into my face tenderly, lovingly. He said nothing for a minute, only looked at me like that. Well, he said, run and play now. Enjoy life for me too. I went out then and ran to play, and many times in my life afterwards I remembered, even with tears, how he told me to enjoy life for him too. There were many other marvellous and beautiful sayings of his, though we did not understand them at the time. He died the third week after Easter. He was fully conscious, though he could not talk. Up to his last hour he did not change. He looked happy, his eyes beamed, and sought us. He smiled at us, beckoned us. There was a great deal of talk, even in a small town, about his death. I was impressed by all this at the time, but not too much so, though I cried a great deal at his funeral. I was young then, a child, but a lasting impression, a hidden feeling of it all, remained in my heart, ready to rise up and respond when the time came. So, indeed, it happened. All right, there we go. That's part A of this chapter. Complete. Have your say about this section of the chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thank you for listening tonight, and I will see you tomorrow.